I write of Earth. And you would enclose the land all around the Earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the rail.
Good afternoon and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for July 10th, 2018. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. The opinions expressed on Corporations and Democracy are those of our guests and the hosts and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. On today's program, we're going to have Leave Terra Firma and Venture Off the Planet and Into Space. President Trump recently announced the creation of an entirely new branch of the military, the Space Force, which was an uh-oh moment for us hosts of the program. So we'll spend most of today's program with a co-founder of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, Bruce Gagnon. And during the second half of the program, we'll add to our conversation a local attorney and founder of the Space Treaty Project, Dennis O'Brien. Bruce Gagnon co-founded the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space in 1992 and has worked on space issues for 30 years. His articles have appeared in over a dozen publications, more than I have time to name here, but two of which were chosen for the annual 25 Most Censored Stories from Project Censored. Those were back in 2005 and in 1999. Regular listeners will recall that we feature Project Censored's annual list of most censored stories here on Corporations and Democracy every year, around November or December. In 2003, Bruce co-produced the popular documentary video titled Arsenal of Hypocrisy. It spelled out how U.S. plans for space domination. In 2010, he was extensively featured in the award-winning documentary called Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. He's also a host of a public access television show called This Issue that currently runs in 13 communities in the state of Maine. And he co-hosts a weekly radio show at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. He's also an active member of Veterans for Peace, about which I should mention in first full disclosure that I am the secretary of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace here in Mendocino County. So let's look at the implications of weaponizing space with President Trump's proposed new Space Force branch of the military. Bruce Gagnon, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
I would like to open the program with a compliment to you, if you don't mind.
Thank you.
Your bio online mentions much more that you've been involved in, including many articles and many publications. But my favorite article of yours, which includes one of the best quotations that I've ever heard, is not mentioned in your bio online. And I'd like to mention that before we get into the meat of today's program. I have that book and I have that quote right here in my hand. It's an essay from an essay in a book called The Military-Industrial Complex at 50. And that was published back in 2011. 2011 being the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's last speech to the country, in which he quoted the term the military-industrial complex. But in that essay, you said something that struck me then, it stuck with me since, and which I've even mentioned a few times right here on this radio station. And essentially, in more words than I'm going to say, you said that when weapons are your number one industrial export product, as they are for America, what's your marketing strategy? So thank you for that. I'll always remember it and repeat it here from the station. That very short, succinct, and very meaningful to me. Thank you for that.
All right. Actually, that's one of my partner's favorite quotes of mine, too. She mentions it quite often as well.
Yeah.
That's, glad you liked it.
Yeah, really, it just lays it out where all our exports are, the why of it. But in the news lately has been, Trump is in the news every day, but one of the recent things that got everybody's attention is announcing a sixth arm of the military, the Space Force, and I guess a lot of people are really enthused about that. Is this a new name for something we're already doing, or is it a new threat?
Well, I think it would be a dramatic escalation and dramatic expansion of what we're already doing. Currently, there is a U.S. Space Command that is under the Air Force. And I must say that the Air Force is not at all happy about Trump's proposal for creating a separate military service branch, the Space Force. They feel like they should be in charge of the current space militarization, weaponization program, and they think it would be a bureaucratic waste. And they're probably right about that, that it would be, you know, create a lot more bureaucracy, waste a lot more money. They'd have to have a lot more generals at high levels and separate buildings and this and that and everything else. But there's something else going on here that I think is really important, and I only saw a reporting of this in one place, and it was in one of the space industry websites where they outlined how the bill is being introduced by an Alabama congressman. In fact, in the last session of Congress, he introduced it to create the Space Force, and it passed the House of Representatives, but the Senate refused to even discuss it, and so it died. And so they're trying to revive it. But this Alabama representative is from the Huntsville area, and Huntsville mm-hmm. is where the Army Space Command is located, and also where Redstone Arsenal is located. And for those not familiar with the sordid history of Redstone Arsenal, it is the place that after World War II, the U.S. smuggled in 1,500 of the top Nazi operatives into the U.S. in a program called Operation Paperclip. And 100 of those Nazis were Wernher von Braun, who was Hitler's rocket scientist that created the V-1 and V-2 rockets that were used to terrorize the European cities toward the end of World War II as Hitler was losing. So they were brought to the U.S., to Huntsville, Alabama, along with 100 copies of the V-2 rocket to create the U.S. space program. And today, it's so big, so much money has gone into that community. They say there are more engineers there than any other place in America. They call it the Pentagon of the South. And so they're... this particular space industry publication was reporting that we now have regional competition between Huntsville, Alabama, and Colorado Springs, Colorado, where the Air Force Space Command is currently headquartered. And so, in addition to the Air Force and the Army being, you know, competing with one another, it's become a regional battle between two space, quote unquote, military space cities. So this is a lot of what's being driven here.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you about rivalry with other countries. It's going to trigger a new space race, but I can see we've got quite a bureaucratic rival situation going on here, which is like a million times worse than it has been.
Actually, this is deja vu all over again, because before the Air Force existed, there was inter-service rivalries about its creation, or when its creation was debated. That was between the two world wars, I imagine, but correct me if you remember that one by better than I do. You know, there's the Army Air Corps, that existed. Yeah. It was strictly to support troops, and then the Air Force was created as a whole separate arm of the military.
Yeah, that was coming out of World War II.
World War II, it was, okay.
Yeah.
So can we look now to China and Russia and everybody else trying to get together their hardware in space, their militarized space? Is it going to be an arms race out there?
Well, you know, for a long time now, I've been working on space full-time, nearly full-time, and now full-time. In the early years, I coordinated the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice mm-hmm. and the global network, so it was only sort of part-time working on space issues. But I started working on it in 83, and Soon after that, Russia and China annually were going to the United Nations, putting forward a new treaty called the PAROS, P-A-R-O-S, called Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space. And they were saying, look, none of us can afford a new arms race in space financially. It'll bankrupt all of us. In fact, the industry has long been saying, the aerospace industry has been saying, that Star Wars would be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth, necessitating massive funding. And so Russia and China said, look, let's close the door to the barn before the horse gets out. And so every year they go to the UN, they bring forward this treaty, it's brought to the floor of the General Assembly, it overwhelmingly passes with just the U.S. and Israel, and they get one or two other countries. Recently they've got Ukraine, sometimes they get the Marshall Islands to vote on their side. But the U.S. and Israel have been blocking at the in Geneva, where negotiations would develop at the UN office in Geneva around this, if the U.S. was serious. So the U.S. and Israel blocking the development of such a treaty. And the position of the U.S. has always been, through both Republican and Democrat administrations, so whether it was Clinton or Obama or Bush or Trump, any of them, they all have just said the same thing. Hey, there's no problem. There's no weapons in space. We don't need a new treaty to ban weapons in space. And the reason, of course, that's very disingenuous. The reason why the United States has always opposed it is because our industry saw a new arms race in the making, and they wanted to control it. They wanted to be in charge of it. And that's where the whole concept of full-spectrum dominance came from, that the U.S. is the exceptional nation. We should lead the world. We should control the world on behalf of corporate capital, and we should be in charge of space. And so one of their planning documents, called Vision for 2020, came out in the late 90s, said the U.S. would control and dominate space and deny other countries access to space, that in fact we would be the master of space. And at the Air Force Space Command headquarters building in Colorado Springs at Peterson Air Force Base, on the doorway, it reads, Master of Space.
Well, Master of Space. This is a whole new meaning for empire here, while the rest of the world is trying to bring about some kind of shared situation. You make a distinction between militarization of space and weaponization of space. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's an important distinction. Militarization means using space with our military satellites up there. The U.S. today has 1,700 operational satellites, most of which are military. U.S. spends, by the way, 10 times more than any, all other countries combined on military space. So the idea that often is put out that Russia and China are coming up and closing the gap and everything else, and we've got to, you know, go forward, is just nonsense. But military satellites actually control all warfare today on the Earth. And so when George W. Bush launched Shock and Awe in 2003 in Iraq, in that initial attack, 70% of the weapons that were used were directed and guided to their targets by military satellites. So everything the Pentagon does, troops on the ground, in tanks, on planes, on ships, airplanes, whatever, drones, everything is directed by military satellites. So that's the militarization of space, spying, surveillance, reconnaissance, interception of fax emails, voice phone calls by NSA facilities all over the planet. It's all done through satellite technology. That's the militarization of space. But now adding the additional idea of putting weapons in space, that's a whole new level, and that's what we call the weaponization of space, and that's where the U.S. is moving now.
Yeah, wow. So that sort of explains why you say that the Persian Gulf War and even the war in Eastern Europe, the Yugoslavia, that these were actually space wars.
And field tests, very importantly.
Field tests.
field tests for the program. The Persian Gulf War, they say, that's back in the early 90s. George W. Bush was president. George Herbert Walker Bush, mm-hmm. Daddy Bush, he was president at the time. And they say that was the first space war. Now, when I say they say, what I'm saying is that this was reported in magazines like Aviation Week and Space Technology, that prior to the war, the U.S. used its military satellites to pre-identify all of Saddam Hussein's military targets, even the his communication cables that ran under the desert floor. They could see them from space. So in the first literally 2 to 3 days of the war, the United States bombed 95% of those targets. The war was over at that time. But then they continued the war for several weeks. And the reason why they did that, they played cat and mouse with Iraq, and they did it because they wanted to field test all of their technologies that they had been putting together over some years. They'd never really had a chance to play it all out. And so that's what they did. And of course, by extending the war for several weeks, they used a lot more military hardware, which they had to replace. They were working three shifts a day in Titusville, Florida, to replace the cruise missiles, because they used 100 of them in the initial attack. Then you go to the time when Bill Clinton was in office, later on in the 90s, and when the U.S. and NATO attacked Yugoslavia, broke Yugoslavia to pieces, balkanized it, destroyed that socialist country. That was the second space war. That was the first time they used cyber warfare. They actually were able to essentially, if you can imagine, crawl inside of Yugoslavia's air defense systems. So before they were attacked, the U.S., through space technology, crawled into the, or hacked, I guess is the more modern term, hacked the air defense systems of Yugoslavia so that when U.S. and NATO planes flew over Belgrade bombing, they couldn't respond. They couldn't defend themselves. They couldn't try to shoot those planes out of the sky because their systems had been shut down. So this was the second space war where they introduced the technology of cyber warfare.
And so the Air Force Cyber Command, which is a separate entity, it's all involved in the space program, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's another one where we're spending way more than anybody else in the world. The United States has set up all of these technology programs for cyber warfare, but we're constantly saying, we're constantly hearing, oh, my God, China, China, Russia, China, Russia, China, Russia. And they do that to frighten the people and get the people to accept spending huge amounts of money on even more technologies that give the United States control and domination.
So there's also something called the Missile Defense Agency. Where does that fit in here?
Well, let's go back to Ronald Reagan. When he was president, he introduced Star Wars, as it was popularly called at the time. He named it the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. And people laughed about it at the time. Mainstream media trashed it. In those days, you could actually get some decent stories in the mainstream media. But so much money was pumped into that program. I remember one time watching one of the network television shows during, dinner time when you're watching the news, and they did a story about there was so much money pumped into the Star Wars program during the Reagan administration. They couldn't spend it all. And they went into a building, a weapons production facility, and people were just sitting around with nothing to do because the technology had not been advanced enough in order to spend all of those funds. And so those corporations, the aerospace industry, had all this excess profit on hand. And what they did was they began buying up media, radio, television, newspapers around the country. And so today, they now control much of that. And so that's why you can't see any stories in the mainstream media about the waste, fraud, and abuse in this whole space program today that we have. So as a result of that, they then continued on. And so after Bill Clinton became president, I started getting phone calls from people saying, Bruce, why are you still working on Star Wars? Didn't you hear that Clinton shut down Reagan's SDI. He shut it down. It's over with. And what they didn't know, that Clinton did, in fact, announce in a news conference that he was shutting down SDI and he was taking the money out of it. But what they didn't know, the next day, he created the thing called BIMDO, the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, and he moved the money from SDI into BIMDO, and they continued doing the same work to create Star Wars. When George W. Bush became president, he renamed it to MDA, the Missile Defense Agency, and they're doing the same work today. So it's just the name of the Pentagon agency that is doing the majority of the research and development on the Star Wars program. And they rename it every now and then just to keep the people confused.
Well, it's working, I'll tell you.
Yeah, now you said that extra funds were used to buy media agencies. So is this the contractors that had so much extra money that are the names that we would recognize that bought the media outlets at that time?
Yeah, the big weapons corporations. You know, there have been a lot of mergers since Reagan's time. Used to be Martin Marietta, and there used to be Lockheed.
Mm-hmm.
And now they merged. Now you have Lockheed Martin.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a lot of mergers. Yeah, but it's those corporations, those aerospace corporations, that had these excess profits and that they used them to buy up a lot of the media.
Hmm.
That's a really, really wonderful insight. I had not heard that before, that all the excess military money enabled the contractors to go out and buy up the media. That's kind of an important piece of the whole puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for bringing that up.
Regarding the domination of space, which we touched on a few minutes ago, versus parity and something more equal for different countries, that was addressed originally some years back in the movie that was I mentioned in the intro. That's The Arsenal of Hypocrisy. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, that was back in 2003. A friend and I, at that time I was living in Gainesville, Florida, and we had a supporter who took me on a speaking tour of Pennsylvania, and he drove me all over the state, and he was really alarmed, you know, at hearing my story night in and night out. It was about a week-long speaking tour. And he told me, you know, you need to make a video, Bruce, about all this, so get it out there. And I said, yeah, well, you know, that'd be nice, but we don't really have any money. He said, don't worry, I'll pay for it. So I had a friend that ran a video shop, and one day I was in there. He used to make copies for me of various videos. I was in there, and we were just talking, and I was telling him, you know, this friend suggested I should make a video, and he said, I'll do it. I said, have you ever made a video before? And he said, never. I said, perfect, let's do it. So there we went. We created this video. I wrote the script. We went to his hot garage in hot Florida in the middle of summer, and we made this video. He filmed me, and then speaking from my script, and after that we sat down together and went through this thing frame by frame together and inserted pictures and various images and everything else, and then we put it out there, and it became like a cult favorite. People would make copies and bootleg them and send them, you know, around, and, you know, went all over, and people would put it on the internet and share it, and so it got distribution all over the planet, and it's really held up well over the years. So I told the whole story, not only about the militarization of space, the weaponization of space, the Nazi background, but also the mining of the sky, and how the U.S. wants to control which corporations, which countries, which individuals can go out and mine the sky, as asteroids and comets and planets have resources, and the technology has now got to the point where they're just about ready to go out and be able to do that. But the UN very smartly years ago created the Moon Treaty and the Outer Space Treaty that said nobody can claim ownership of these planetary bodies. They're the province of all humankind. And they smartly did it because they realized that if they didn't, there would be competition out in space, and we would move the war system off the planet Earth into the heavens, and they didn't want to see us do that. But during the Obama administration, he signed a new bill giving individuals and corporations the right to go out and make land claims on asteroids, which would violate these two treaties, the Moon Treaty and the Outer Space Treaty, at the United Nations. And so here we are, the United States, moving in this direction. And over the years, I've collected a whole series of books and documents that tell all these stories. This is where I learned all these things. And so in this video, Arsenal of Hypocrisy, we show these books, these, you know, documents, and make it real for people, prove that I'm not just making this shit up as I go along. So you can find this if you go to our website, spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org. We have in our menu a thing called Space Videos, and you just go there and you'll find a whole host of videos that have been made on this issue over the years, including Arsenal of Hypocrisy, and another one that you mentioned in the opening, which I think is a really fine one, called Pax Americana, The Weaponization of Space, done by a French filmmaker. Is a real, and he had it in movie theaters in Spain and in Australia, and he had it on national, like public television, and throughout Europe, in France and other countries, Canada, because they funded, public television in Europe funded the development of this movie, but he could not get it shown in the United States. He could not find anyone to distribute the film at all in the United States, for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners, we're speaking with Bruce Gagnon, who is the co-founder of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, and we're discussing the implications of the new branch of the military proposed by President Trump, the Space Force.
I'd like to finish that. We were talking about the Space Force, and I never quite finished that thought, that it has to be approved. Trump's proposal is just a proposal. It has to be approved by both the House and the Senate. And so far, it's been brought to the House. They voted in favor of it. The Senate wouldn't take it up. And so there's apparently quite a few people in the Senate that are not in favor of it. A lot of generals are not in favor of it. The Air Force is not in favor of it. So it's not a done deal yet. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling people that if you're opposed to the idea of the Space Force, which we ought to be, then the way to defeat it is to fight for social progress. Because some years ago in Space News, one of the industry weeklies, a weekly newspaper, they had an editorial saying, you know, we've got to be responsible corporate citizens. We've got to come up with a dedicated funding source to pay for all of these space technology programs. And we have. And we're now sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure that funding source. And they went on to say in the editorial, it's the entitlement programs that officially in America are Social Security, mm-hmm. Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program. These are the programs that the aerospace industry has identified for defunding in order to pay for programs like the Space Force. So if you want to stop the Space Force, fight for Social Security, fight for Medicare, fight for Medicaid, push for Medicare for all, national health care, right? For everybody. Push for those programs, fight for them, and we might be able to stop this full bore weaponization of space that they want to do.
And again, some of those documents and some of the videos are at your website, which we'll mention later in the program again also, but that's spaceforpeace.org, and that four is the numeral for spaceforpeace.org.
Or the word, either way.
Oh, okay, both ways.
Yeah, you can go either way.
Okay, we are at the half-hour mark, or slightly after. If any listeners would like to call in and join the conversation, the number here is 895-2448 here at the studio in Philo.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you've done a really good job of is painting a picture of what it looks like, the satellite download stations that the U.S. has all over the world, and what kind of regulation there is over those places. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, and you know, every year the Global Network, we're 26 years together now as an organization, founded in 1992, and every year we have an annual meeting in a different country early on, we discovered that all over the planet, the U.S. has set up bases, what are called downlink stations, and they're like satellite relay stations, and they're in England, they're in Norway, they're in Japan, they're in New Zealand and Australia, and, many, many different countries, including the United States. And their job, as satellites orbit the Earth, the satellites send the signal down just below to one of these relay stations at one of these bases. And so that's how they communicate in what's called real time, split second time. These signals bounce from satellite to relay station to other satellite and all the way back to command central back in the United States. And so we discovered early on that at most of these places around the world, there were peace groups in these countries saying, hey, we don't want our country to be used for Star Wars. So these organizations became the membership and the leadership of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And so it's every year we hold a annual meeting in a different country. Just last month, the end of June, we met in England, just outside of Oxford, England. And so at the end of June, we held our 26th annual meeting there and then had a protest at this Croughton Air Force Base and just outside of Oxford. And we learn more about this base. So every time we hold a meeting in a different country, the local people who know most about these bases, they teach our folks that have come from different countries, and then we all share with each other our local stories so that we have a bigger and broader picture of what the U.S. is doing now globally to set up this space-directed warfare system. So that's what we do.
Yeah, so that all of these places, too, and what kind of controls or laws have to do with what goes on at these satellite download places? They sort of out of reach of some of the things that we would like to see happen to control what goes on?
Well, of course. In fact, whether it's England or Japan or Australia or New Zealand or Germany or wherever, the host country is not even allowed to know what happens there. So in the case of Croughton in England, outside Oxford, the English government doesn't even know what goes on there.
Wow. Well, so we do have another call on line 4. So, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I had the radio down while I was in, but what were you guys just speaking about?
Oh, well, were you trying to call in on this show about the space, the militarization of space?
Yeah, I am actually, but I just don't want to double up my question. But I'll go ahead and ask it anyways. There's a growing body of evidence on the internet, that shows a correlation between nuclear testing and the rise of UFO sightings and interesting stories about, otherworldly type technology that's entered the scene correlating with the nuclearization of our planet. And then there's a lot of interesting testimony from military folks, particularly through the Disclosure Project, that shows people going on record, willing to go before court and discuss their experiences where they've tried to launch nuclear weapons into space and seen these UFOs come in and disable these. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. And I'll take my question off the air.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, do you see a correlation there?
Well, I follow all that UFO issue very closely. I'm very interested in it. I believe that we're not the only, quote-unquote, intelligent life in the universe. That seems a bit arrogant to believe that. I believe that our planet has been and is likely still being visited by people from other planetary bodies. What connection they have to what's going on today, in terms of the arms race, whether it's nuclear or space, I don't know. I don't have any information about that. I haven't seen any direct links, anyone that has direct links to that. But I have seen these testimonies of U.S. military officers and others who have seen UFOs, and many of these people say they've seen aliens as well. And I don't doubt their what they've said at all.
So another thing that you talk about that's very graphic is massive space debris and how we're likely going to make a whole lot more of it and how that's going to confine us to Earth. Those are some interesting ideas that you put forward.
Yeah, you know, when I lived in Florida, I used to organize frequent protests at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station and also the Kennedy Space Center, which are basically right next door to each other. And one time we had one of the Apollo astronauts, Edgar Mitchell, walked on the moon. He came and spoke at one of our protests, and he talked quite a bit about space debris. And what he said was that if we ever had one war in space where we were blowing up each other's satellites, things like that, that we would create so much space debris that we would not be able to ever get a rocket off the planet Earth again. That it would be like a minefield surrounding our planet, and we wouldn't be able to get through it, and that we would be then entombed, he said, to the planet. So this has become a real problem now for the space warriors, as they call themselves at the Space Command. Their original plan, their original idea, was to just go up and blow up other countries' satellites like Russia or China during moments of hostility, which would give the U.S. control and domination of space. But now they're having to rejigger and reconnoiter and refigure that whole strategy. And now they're really kind of with new ideas about how they can control space without creating more space junk, because it's such a big problem.
Is there an update you can give us about the infamous destruction of a satellite that China did about, 8-10 years ago, something like that? And that was intentional to test out, I believe, the destruction of a satellite intentionally and created, I don't know how much debris, but whatever happened to that?
Yeah, that was an anti-satellite weapon, or as they call in the business, an ASAT. China tested the capability. They blew up one of their old satellites, one of their own old non-functioning satellites, and it created more space debris up there. They did it on purpose in order to show the United States that we're not going to allow you to be the master of space. You think you're going to be the master of space? You're not going to be. We're not going to let you do it. We'd rather have a treaty. You won't agree to it. So we're sending you a signal.
Okay.
The United States has also done the same thing, by the way. We have anti-satellite weapons. We've blown up one of our own satellites as well.
Well, given the throwaway culture that we are, the cure might be in the disease.
Okay, we have just dialed in a second guest, and so we'd like to have you both on the line for the rest of the program, and that is Dennis O'Brien. He's a retired attorney here in Mendocino County, former member of the NASA Hastings Law Project in San Francisco, and he did a treaty a few decades back on called OTV, An Argument for the Independent Trader, and that somewhat presaged the current public-private model for the exploration and development of outer space. And he's recently started the Space Treaty Project, which educates the public about the benefits of the agreement governing the activities of states on the moon and other celestial bodies, commonly known as the Moon Treaty. So that is proposed by the United Nations, but apparently not yet ratified by the United States and other spacefaring nations. But it calls for an international legal regime that will protect the common heritage of mankind while providing regulatory certainty for economic interests. So, Denny, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what luck we have here to have both of you on right now. Thank you so much. And, Denny, you're a local from Ukiah, and you've been working on this issue for a while, too. It looks like we're looking at is just now anybody, they open it up to, NASA open it up to private businesses, and anybody just go out and catch an asteroid and start mining on it. Is that what it's looking like to you right now?
That's what the United States is trying to do, even though most countries, there's an international effort to create an international legal framework of laws to coordinate and otherwise regulate the exploitation of space resources. But the United States in 2015, and I will distinguish a bit from your other guest, the new Space Act was passed by the Republicans in both the House of Representatives and the Senate once they finally took over the Senate in the 2014 elections. Before then, it didn't happen. So this is essentially a Republican. The Space Act is a Republican invention. I'll acknowledge that Obama signed
it.
He just didn't want to veto anything. But setting the politics aside, what the Space Act does is that it specifically grants property rights to any, what they refer to as a U.S. citizen, who gets to an asteroid first, or gets to a space resource first, including asteroids. This is a first-come, first-serve type of approach that has been denounced in various international conferences on space law. There's a fear that since there are only a few countries and a few corporations within those countries that have the technical capacity to reach some of these space resources, that what's going to happen is that new monopolies are going to be formed in outer space. Indeed, some fear it may be a new wave of colonialization, just as what happened 500 years ago when the Europeans, who had some advanced technology when it came to long-distance sea travel and cannons, were able to essentially dominate world trade, if not the world, for the next few hundred years. So there's a fear that that's going to happen again if the model that has been presented by the United States moves forward.
Now, Bruce has already talked a little bit about some of the different entities there are that are, you know, treaties that are people or the world is trying to put forward. Do you want to talk a little bit about some of those Outer Space Treaty of 1967 and there's the Moon Treaty?
Yes.
What are all these things here and how do they work?
The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 has been ratified by most of the world's countries, including all of the countries that have the technical ability to get into space. It is sometimes called the Constitution of Outer Space Law. As a treaty that has been ratified by the United States Senate, it is legally binding upon the United States. It's just like any other law. You shouldn't just be able to get out from under it. However, the United States and the Space Act, back up one moment, the Outer Space Treaty of 67 says that no country can establish sovereignty over any place in space, either by any means, by being there, by using it, anything. You just can't establish sovereignty. So when the United States, a couple of years ago, unilaterally granted property rights to its own corporations if they got to some space resource first, many in the international community condemn this as an act of sovereignty. You can't give someone property rights unless you're asserting your own control and your own laws over that piece of property, whether it be water at the North Pole of the Moon, or an asteroid full of precious minerals or metals. You just can't do that. Even though the law itself, and it's kind of cute in the Space Act, after it says these things, it then says it is the declaration of Congress that this act does not interfere with any of the obligations of the United States under various treaties. And, of course, the international conferences have now come back complaining that you just can't get out from under a treaty by declaring that your law is not in violation of it. So there's a tough debate going on just based on the Outer Space Treaty. Now, the newer treaty, sometimes it's called the Moon Treaty, even though it applies to the entire solar system except for the Earth. The new treaty specifically says that there must be an international framework of laws that is created to deal with space commerce. Just briefly, it says that the main purposes of this international framework shall include, one, the orderly and safe development of natural resources, two, the rational management of those resources, three, and here's where it gets tricky, the expansion of opportunities in the use of those resources, and finally, and this is where it gets even more tricky, an equitable sharing by all states in the benefits derived from those resources, whereby the interests and needs of the developing countries, as well as the efforts of the countries who have done it, shall be given special consideration. Now, those last two things just freak out the corporations, U.S. corporations, who are trying to get out there and make money on this. They do not want to be bound by any law that says they have to share in the opportunity of developing these resources or somehow share the benefits, which some read as profits, from this utilization of resources. This is a huge battle. I went to a conference in April in Colorado, and there was a clear line between what I call the nationalists and the internationalists. The nationalists, mainly from the United States, also Luxembourg, believe it or not, Luxembourg is going to be the new Panama when it comes to spacefaring, as Panama was for oceans. But the internationalists are saying you can't just go out and claim this stuff. We must develop an international framework of laws that will, while giving corporations the ability to make a profit, is still going to protect the public policy interests of the rest of humanity. And, that's the short answer, or maybe the long answer to your question about the two treaties that are involved here and what the ramifications are.
Okay, so that's the Moon Treaty, and a big problem with that, of course, is that you say that none of the countries that actually have space programs have signed it.
Yeah, that is a problem, although there is some movement in that direction. Just last month, China announced an agreement with the United Nations whereby any country that's a member of the United Nations will have access to the Chinese space station to run experiments there, and any future China bases, for example, on the moon. So China is, on its own, even before this treaty is signed or before signing the treaty themselves, are trying to open it up so that their space program does benefit other countries, especially the developing countries.
Okay, that's the voice of Denny O'Brien. And Bruce Gagnon, do you want to comment on the situation with the treaties?
Well, you know, it's I basically agree with everything he said, and except just one thing. I don't know if people heard me, that he said it was the Republicans that passed this bill to allow American corporations and individuals to make land claims on the asteroids, but it was Barack Obama, a Democrat, that signed the bill into law. He could have vetoed it, and he didn't. So, you know, this has always been a bipartisan thing. But I have a book here at the House called Military Space Forces, the Next 50 Years. It was commissioned by the Congress of the United States. The foreword of it is signed by the likes of former Senator John Glenn, who was an astronaut, and many other politicians. And in there, they have a section where they talk about, we've got to control the Earth-Moon gravity well with our military forces, because that will enable us essentially to control the front gate of the base, or the front gate of the military base. Mm-hmm. It would allow the U.S. to determine who could get on and off the planet as people eventually wanted to go out and mine the sky. And in one section in this book, they say, with our military space forces lying in wait at that location, we could hijack rival shipments upon return. So the U.S. has long been committed to this idea of control and domination, and that we would determine who gets to move off the planet, who gets to mine the sky, who gets to make money from it, and who doesn't. Well, this is introducing the global war system that is sown into the depths of the consciousness of the people on this planet.
I can't agree with that.
Okay, go ahead, Danny.
I can't agree with that, and I can't agree with throwing the entire U.S. government and all political parties into the same mix on this stuff. There are a lot of people in the system and without who are trying to change that mindset. The United Nations has come up with what they call sustainable development goals. There's 17 of them, including things like ending poverty, ending hunger. Well, if we had more time, I would go more into them. Sustainability is the key.
I surely would like to hear the names of anybody in the Democratic Party who is opposed to anything that we're doing with the space program today.
Well, I would say any of the peacenicks are. But we could go on forever about that particular discussion. What's important is that there is a treaty out there that can be used to move things forward. And it's also important that we don't just leave it up to the politicos, because this stuff can get lost in the noise. Now, there's so much going on these days, and Trump, as they say, uses up the oxygen with all this sideshow stuff.
Sounds like an opportunity.
But the space treaty, the moon treaty, if it is ratified by enough countries, it is going to force the adoption of an international framework of laws to move forward together as humanity. Now, we can argue about where any political party is at this point, but the important point is that we must all work together as a group
to come up with the laws for the future
of humanity in the United States.
Okay,
because if we don't do that, there's going to be no hope for humanity.
I had no idea there would be any argument between you two. I thought you would be reinforcing each other, but we're almost out of time.
Don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong. I'm not opposed to these treaties. Of course, I support them. But, Dennis, there was a time when the Democrats, just in recent years, controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency. Did they, at that time, support the ratification of the Moon Treaty?
Certain priorities were different at different times. They had to put all their political eggs into getting health care sustainable to make that sustainable for everyone. I do wish they had done this. But it was certainly not at the top of the agenda. A few years later, now that technology and science has gone a few steps further, it now becomes very apparent that we need to pay attention to this. Even the Moon Treaty says we'll only make these laws about space commerce when it becomes absolutely necessary because of the advances in technology. That time is now. Now is the time to make everyone aware of this. And in fact, now is the time to start putting pressure on the Democrats, on the Senate. And hopefully, if the Senate is flipped in a few months, then it will be possible. You know, when Ocasio won that primary.
Hang on there, Denny, because we are going to run into a time problem. So
Denny, hang on.
We're going to run out of time to go that direction. Let me briefly just ask. The context of these debates is at the UN, some of it at the national government here in the U.S., of course. Just tell me briefly what is coming up, where you'll both be speaking at events coming up, where citizen diplomacy takes place at independent events. Denny, you go first. There's one you might be talking at in a few months.
We only have, less than two minutes.
Okay. In October, early October, first week, I will be at the International Astronautical Congress in Germany. It is the preeminent annual gathering of people in the field, and I will be talking with them about the necessity for adopting the Moon Treaty as a way to force countries like our own to enter into an international framework of laws so that we as humanity can go into space together rather than setting up another round of corporate dominance.
Okay, and Bruce, to you, and we have just 30 seconds or so.
Then that's it. No kidding.
Every year in October, we have a thing called Keep Space for Peace Week. Mm-hmm. This year, it'll be October 6th through the 13th. We urge people all over the world to hold local activities, protests, meetings, educational forums around all of these issues for the peaceful exploration of space.
Okay, great. Well, super. Thank you for both being on the air with us. Bruce Gagnon, co-founder of the Global Network Against Weapons in Nuclear and Nuclear Power in Space, and Dennis O'Brien, working on the Space Treaty Project. That's at spacetreaty.org. Bruce's work can be found at Space for Peace. That's the digit or the numeral for spaceforpeace.org. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.